So I get that even in a group of this size, our experiences with moms will vary more than a little. And I get that as a guy, I am at best in the margins of the people groups that should be addressing a community on Mother's Day. And for sure, it would be a strange and presumptuous thing for me to stand up here on Mother's Day and do something as weird as telling everyone in the room that is a mom or that has a mom how the thing we call mothering should be done. That would be very strange business indeed. It would be, in my opinion, crazier still for me to suggest that I have some kind of special insight into being a mom given to me. Why would such an insight be given to me? Well, let's see. What are the possible reasons? Because I'm a man. Because I'm a pastor. I'm an expert on God. Right? Or because I'm a dad. So basically, aside from like patriarchy, religious power structures, and deeply conventional, traditional North American view of family, I am not the person who should be up here talking to you on Mother's Day. And usually I'm not. But this year, for a variety of reasons, I'm the person that's standing up and talking while the rest of the group is sitting down and listening. So, how shall I use this perhaps ill-gotten position that I have to do something useful on this potentially hazardous day, on Mother's Day? Well, I want to attempt to do two things this morning. First of all, I want to reflect a bit on my mom. And in particular, I want to name some of the things that my mom taught me about God. And you should just, I don't know if this will be helpful for you or not, but in this particular instance, at least, and this is not that unusual, everywhere that God occurs in my notes, it's in quotes. And the reason for that is to remind me in text of something that I believe, and also to offer it by way of understanding the talker a little bit more, that that's an ill-defined term. And so in this instance, the convention of quotes says, and this is one of the grammatically useful things that you can do with quotes around a word. It says, this word doesn't mean maybe what you think it means. So when I say God, I know that we all go to different places. What I mean by God is not, in many ways, what my mom means by God. God language is shared language. But what it means is unique to each of us. And what I mean by God when I use that word is sort of this fairly spacious idea for which I would also use a word like divine or creator. We started a conversation last week about spring cleaning our religious closets, and a fair bit of what is in mine could be credited to my mom. And that's true of both things that I value and that I want to keep, and things that I feel otherwise about, which I actually think is quite a natural and beautiful way for things to be. I don't understand that as kind of categorically negative or problematic. So one of the things I want to do is reflect on all of that a little bit. And then the second thing that I want to do together this morning is I want to hear from this gathering of this community about this. I am very curious to hear some of what you learned about God from your moms or from the people in your lives that might hold that kind of role or position. I know that we don't just learn about big ideas from one parent or from any one person, but in most cultures, whoever has that role for which we might use concepts or language like mother, that role does tend to have a unique influence on us. So I'm going to start there. I'm going to start with the unique influence my mom has had on my conceptions of God. Most of what my mom taught me about God, she taught me by loving me. This keeps coming back to mind when I have conversations with parents in this community and otherwise whose faith is shifting, whose framework for what they believe is shifting. We were talking about religious clauses last week, and somebody took the metaphor in describing their religious closet. They said, basically, I've burned mine down. I blew it up, whatever, like it's gone. Or there's, for lots of people that were like, there's not much left in there. There's this little card on the floor that says, be kind. You know, like there's just, right? So all these different kind of images of our religious closet. And what my mom taught me is kind of could be like on a card in the bottom of my religious closet, because most of what she taught me by loving me. And when I talk about to people that are going through that kind of a shift where they feel like there's not much left in their closet, and their parents, and they're like, I don't know what to say to my kid. I don't know how to talk to my kid about God, because I don't know what I believe about God, or what I believe about God is there's not much left on the card. I don't know what to say. And when I started to reflect on what my mom has taught me about how I imagine God these days, this is the centerpiece. Most of what I learned about God from my mom, I did not learn because she said it to me. So, if you feel like there's not much in the, you know, the file of what should I say to my kids about God, my story would suggest that that's actually not a reason to panic. Because most of what I learned about God from my mom, she taught me by loving me. And I am deeply grateful to be able to say that. I do know that it's not at all a given. But as a result, when I think about what my mom taught me about God, I mostly end up thinking about what she taught me about love. Which is quite possibly why, at this stage in my life, my conception of God is pretty much synonymous with my conception of love. If you've been around here any amount of time, you've heard me talk about that, this idea that God is love, not that God is a being that is loving, but that God is love itself and that love is God. And so when I talk about what I learned from my mom about God, the terms love and God are interchangeable. My mom also taught me that love has a bias. To me, this is a pretty interesting idea. Because one of the cherished notions that I grew up surrounded by regarding the divine is that there was sort of a way to describe God that removed them from all of sort of the vicissitudes of humanity, that just sort of said this being sort of has nothing to do with us in terms of how we conceive of them. They're utterly other. And Ray, when you were talking this morning about our bodies and this lesson you learned about our bodies, I was thinking in terms of the temporal nature of our human embodied experience, I think there's a lot there in that lesson. And then I was also thinking of something that I think it was Richard Rohr that I heard say recently, this idea that God, what God loves, God becomes. And so we're surrounded by the sacred. And when we breathe together, we are participating in that. So our body is not something to be disdained or discarded or misused, but rather something to cherish and nurture, because it is not just the home of God. If God is love and love is God, we are the overflow of love. Like this experience of us is the overflow of love. So this idea that love has a bias is interesting to me, because that a lot of the picture that I was taught formally about God as a youngster would suggest that that's a bad idea, that God has a bias, that God might be biased. Because then who's God for and who's God against? Well, God's obviously for the tribe that gets it right and against the tribes that get it wrong. So God's against us and for the large evangelical church that's, you know, somewhere on the perimeter, right? Like clearly, or however you want to characterize it, for and against, right? So that's what happens to this idea. But for my mom, I feel like what I learned from my mom about the nature of the divine is that the divine does have a bias. Now, it's not that, and this is about seeing faults, it's not that my mom can't see my faults. Like, I would say that of all the humans on the earth, my mom has seen as many of my faults at close range as anybody alive. Kreen, my wife, is probably the exception to that statement. But as far as I can tell, what my mom sees when she looks at me is not my faults. What she sees is my potential. What she sees is my capacity for what is good. What she sees is what is worthwhile about me, what is beautiful about me. Her love isn't blind, but it can be really, really short-sighted. And so when I imagine the love that is God, that's a really important part of what I imagine. I imagine a love that is for me, that is for you, that is for us, that is biased. It's not blind, but it for sure has a bias, and that bias is for the thriving of all that is, including all of us. By all of us, I do not mean the people in this room. I mean all of us. I learned that about God from my mom. My mom taught me that love is not a doormat. Now, my mom is about as sweet a human being as you could imagine. In fact, when I was a little kid, I just thought my mom was sweet. Like God is love. Like that was the whole story. Now, I get that that's a little bit odd in terms of a childhood memory because my mom was very capable of the whole role of being a mom. She was able to, you know, raise four kids and keep the troops in line and, oh yeah, help her husband run a business. And I mean, there was obviously stern stuff there, but somehow my childhood memory is that sweetness prevailed. And it wasn't until I was much older, senior high or so, that I had occasion to be in the stands with her at one of my younger brother's hockey games and watch her reaction to a bad call that had her kid at the butt end of the call. And then I felt like I sort of had this really clear shot at the ferocity that lived underneath the sweetness. I don't want any of you to misimagine my mom. She is occasionally a guest here at the table. But that was the day where I learned that those boards and hockey rinks are not just there to protect the fans from the players, but also the people on the ice from the fans. Man, there was horsepower. By the way, if I bring this up with my mom, this particular incident, she can't remember it. And so... What I take from that is that maybe it only happened in my head, but it for sure happened in my head, so it's real. Love, it seems to me, isn't much good in the world if it can't be both tender and ferocious, if it doesn't have range, if it isn't both open and boundary, if you want to use this kind of language, if it isn't able to both take it and dish it out. It doesn't have some strength to it, as well as tenderness. That's a complicated idea. Most ideas about love turn out to be complicated. To use an image from Lisa D'Amour, who is one of my favorite parenting authors, in terms of our interactions with one another, we can be doormats. We can be prickly doormats. So to be a doormat is to be passive, to be a prickly doormat is to be passive-aggressive. Or we can be pillars. We can be people who stand for ourselves but are visibly welcoming to other people and provide them with something that they can depend on, something they can lean on, be in the shade of, push against, challenge. To this day, when I imagine divine love, I imagine a love that is what it is, that welcomes me and you and each of us, but it isn't the sort of love that you can just push around however you wish. And my mom taught me that love is embedded in the everyday. I don't think I know a more giving person than my mom. Honestly, I don't believe that she thinks of her self-donation as a virtue. I think she just thinks it's what you do if you love people, you give yourself to them. That's just what you do. It's not actually up for negotiation. That's how it works. How you do that is unique to you, but sooner or later, it's bound up in the ordinary. It's bound up in things like tasks and responsibilities and chores and jobs. And some of those jobs are quite literally the shitty ones. Love doesn't have to like those parts, but it chooses to enter them. It chooses to deeply occupy them. It chooses to live in them. And there are ways in which love only comes to life in those spaces. And that's a deliberate phrase, that something would come to life. It doesn't just mean become alive. It also means bring life too. I remember a friend of mine talking about marginalized people in their community, and in particular, oh man, this is going to take us deep into the realm of conservative evangelicalism, so as usual with the table, like if you need to leave the room for this part, you can, if this makes you too twitchy. But this was in a religious setting where it was actually a viable question about whether this person, this friend of mine, who was also a colleague at some points, and they were a professional religious person, pastor. It was actually a valid question about whether they could marry a couple who had been living together, not married for a long time, and bless the marriage, so give it the blessing of the church. Parentheses, God have mercy. We can be such idiots in religion, close brackets. So anyway, we were having this conversation, and they said to me, well, frankly, I can't think of anyone that needs a blessing, whatever a blessing is constituted of, more than someone that's on the margins of a community. And in that community at that time, that description of couplehood was on the margins. That description of family was on the margins. So who would need a blessing more than somebody that the community was treating as though they were marginalized? So you can take that idea, of course, and spin it into all sorts of realities, right? Who would need whatever comprises the thing we would use a word like blessing for, more than somebody that was being treated by any community as though they were not welcome? Now, what possible kind of logic would lead religion to say, that's who we're going to withhold the blessing from? All right. None of that's in my notes. I should know better. Pisses me off. My mom taught me that love is embedded in the everyday, which of course is exactly the sort of behavior of love that would make room for all, that would choose to go where the prevailing norms suggest it might be dangerous to go, or where the dominant culture says, that's just where a special few go. That's just where super saints do that stuff. Or people who are exceptionally well compensated to do the difficult or dangerous or ugly or, you know, whatever. Something like that. But something that just says, this is extraordinary. This is not ordinary. What my mom taught me about love being embedded in the everyday is that, no, actually, going to those places and doing those things is ordinary. If love is everyday. That's how it behaves. That's what it does. I know from my conversations with my mom these days that one of the hardest parts of aging for her is diminished capacity and availability to get into the middle of the messes and work through them with the people that she loves. This house move we're still making. Are you tired of house moving stories yet? You just let me know. You tend to work with what's available to you when you're illustrating, you know? Yeah. Right now, if you say the word IKEA, I may be triggered. But I'm not making fun of being triggered. This house move that we're still making reminded me of the last move that we made, which was 15 years ago. And I keep thinking about my mom and my dad coming and just spending a week with us doing all these really ugly jobs that needed to be done. just kind of nonstop. I'm not even going to try to apply this illustration. It's just a fun memory. So one of the things my mom loves to do is paint, and she's done lots of it. My dad owned a construction company, and she worked for him sometimes as a painter. So she knows how to paint, and she likes it. And she was painting one of our kids' bedrooms, and she was up on the short step ladder, and she was painting. And Cale, who was this 15 years ago, right? So he's like this little guy, however old he was, you know. But he's kind of in there with Grandma, just kind of keeping her company, right? And it's hot. And the house didn't have air conditioning, and so we had this, you know, like a oscillating fan in there, kind of going back and forth. And of course, she's painting, so she's taking off doors and stuff. So there's a screwdriver sitting right there. And Cale's looking at this fan, and he's watching the pattern and listening to the sound, and he's thinking, I bet that would sound really cool if you stuck a screwdriver in it. My mom's totally oblivious. She's painting away on the ladder. And so Cale picks up the screwdriver, sticks it in the fan. It's a plastic fan. It's not a plastic screwdriver. Guess what lost? So the fan's just like, wah! It just kind of blows up. And my mom's like, whoa! It goes flying off the ladder. So now we got paint. We got injured mom. We got Cale going, what did I just do? It's a paradigmatic story in our household. It defines many things. But not the least of which is my mom's response, which of course was to, you know, make sure Cale was okay, kind of make sure her ankle wasn't broken and just sprained, and then pick up the paint and, you know, keep painting. Everyday messes, right? Just being in the middle of it. I know that if my mom could, she would be here in the middle of this mess. You know, she can't. So that's hard for her, right? Because it's not diminished love, but it's altered capacity to express it in the everyday. And that's hard because that's her language. That's how this works for her. So when I think about love, what I think about is I think about a force for good that is present in the messiest possible parts of my life and of our lives and of life on and life with this planet, of all that has to do with life. I think that to love is to co-suffer. It is also to co-create and co-celebrate. It is to engage with the full spectrum of the life experience with one another. And when I imagine God as love, that's a huge part of what I imagine. I was having a conversation a few weeks ago with a student at the university who was telling me a difficult part of their story. A part of the story that made them quite angry and distressed to tell. And at one point, they said, like, where was God in that moment? Well, that's a really perennial and compelling human question, isn't it? It's a little bit like the why question in the sense that we feel like we're just driven to ask it, but it's really just impossible to answer in any sort of material way. But I said, what if, like, and what they were sort of asking was, why wasn't there a rescue in the terminate this troubling event way, right? Why didn't God make this stop or make this go away? I said, well, where do you think God was? Like, where did God go? Where is God in any given moment? And so then we ended up having this whole conversation about what happens to the way that we think about the presence of the divine if we think about love as co-suffering. What happens to the way we remember difficult things in our lives or anywhere in our human experience if we are imagining that God is not somewhere else in those moments, declining to intervene? Any more than love is not there in any way, but rather embedded in that suffering. What if there is nowhere that God is absent? Even if sometimes that's impossible for us to perceive. That's an idea with difficulties of its own, I realize. But it is universe-altering in its possibilities. when the Christian tradition enjoins us to weep with those who weep and celebrate with those that celebrate, this is what it's talking about. The idea that love is co-suffering and co-creating and co-celebrating. That there's not somewhere that God is absent, including the very shittiest things that we can imagine or countenance being aware of. Totally different idea than this being that arbitrarily decides where to intervene and not intervene. I learned those things about God, first of all, and in many ways, most of all, from my mom. And most of them I learned, not by what she said, but just because she loved me. Ooh. That's pretty good, right? That's pretty good. So, that doesn't make me more blessed than you, by the way, if that's not your story. Remember what we were just talking about? I've got stuff in my religious closet that's from my mom. I don't even talk with my mom about, because she'd be looking at me like, what? We just don't need to have that conversation. Or in the days where we do need to have a part of it, we have it. And that's fine too, right? I could go on. But I want to hear from the community a little bit. I've focused this morning mostly on what I would call the good lessons, in many ways, that I've learned from my mom. That stuff in my religious closet that I store there out of deference or guilt or because I haven't had the courage or inclination to take it on yet, where that's not what we're talking about this morning. It's bound to show up, of course, because it's there. But like I said a bit ago, I think that's a pretty natural way for things to be. And I know that my kids, of course, have the same sort of mix of stuff to deal with. And again, I think that's quite natural and not always easy, but there's a certain beauty to it as well. So, what about you? What have you learned about love or God from your mom or from the person or people in your life that you think of when you think about some of those kind of roles? I'm going to turn off the recording. As always, when we share as a community, you didn't sign on to have your personal reflections on this shared with the universe. And I tried to choose my words with enough care that if my mom does choose to listen to this particular podcast, I'll still be welcome home for dinner. I'll probably leave that on a recording, Mom, in case you're listening. Love you. Now I'm going to turn it off.